Welcome to Living Life on Purpose on the Living Well Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, Suzanne Streisauer, and I'm a holistic life and career coach. And I've spent decades expanding my own consciousness, and I've found lots of resources for the body, mind, and spirit that I think you're going to love. On Living Life on Purpose, I'm going to be introducing you to many authors and experts on a wide variety of topics, including sustainability, spirituality, optimal health and well-being, and inspirational authors, musicians, and entertainers who are going to give you new insights and possibilities to enhance and enrich your life. Be inspired for life and join me today on Living Life on Purpose. Well, I'm so happy to have everybody joining me here today on Living Life on Purpose, and this is Suzanne, and I was just sort of thinking about what a remarkable time it is. It's the beginning of spring. Spring here in California, everything is blooming. I have almonds on my trees. So for those of you out on the East Coast, just know spring will come. I wish we could make a trade and us give you some of our sunshine and you give us some of your water, because that would be kind of a great thing to have happen. And just sort of a little frame for the show today, we are going to be this is part of International Ideas Month and also Optimism Month. And so my authors today and this month are going to be sharing how they are bringing inspiration to their topics, and all of them are nonfiction authors. So we're going to be doing some interesting things with that. And I have two great nonfiction authors for you during this hour upcoming, and really interesting, very, very different people. Before we get into all that, I want to go and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Podcasting by Professionals. And you can find them at podcastingbyprofessionals.com. They are offering, I'm one of the four in the team of expert podcasters, and we are offering a great podcasting course for podcasting for beginners, and it's a beginning intermediate course for podcasters and people who want to learn how to reach millions of people. So great course. Really reasonably priced, $197. And so check it out, Podcasting by Professionals, and you can see some of the free information we have as well as listen to the program. So I want to just jump right into my show today because I have two great authors, and they're really interesting and fascinating people, and both of them are doing very different work. So we're going to go from one end of the continuum to another one. And so my first guest today is David Clark, who is a retired social worker, recovered alcoholic and sex addict. He also is a radio show host and of a show called Different Strokes for Different Folks, and he's the author of four books and many screenplays, including Shades of Gay and a recent screenplay, Occam's Razor Revisited, and a couple of prior books called The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude and Babes in Bucksnort. So welcome to the show today, David.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, you have a fascinating background, and I interviewed you way back when on Shades of Gay, and, you know, that, like I said on your show, that interview still sticks out to me as one of my ones where I really love that, because we were just so present and the content was so real. And so I want for you to talk about, just to kind of give us a little bit of your own backstory so we can kind of get everybody up to speed of you know, who you've been and then what that led into you becoming an author and radio show host. So tell us a little bit about being a social worker, an addict of various sorts, and you know, what brought you up to today?
Okay, well, I'm a survivor who's turned into a thriver, and I'm on a spiritual journey, as we all are, whether or not we recognize it. And my story began very briefly with being a sex abuse survivor, the son of a mentally ill mother, and that predisposed me towards addiction. There are a lot of abuse survivors that turn into quote-unquote addicts, but of course that's the symptom. What's underneath, as I've learned, is that it is the dis-ease within oneself that creates the seeming addiction. So I am of the opinion that addiction is like any other disease, which is a dis-ease within self, that it can be totally healed by the God power within each of us. And as you said, I'm a recovered alcoholic and sex addict. The sexual addiction was much more difficult to recover from because it's not like putting a substance down. I was a psychiatric social worker for over 20 years. And when I retired at the tender age of 50, I became an author. And I started out by writing my autobiography, which is not published. And when I was done with that, I thought, what am I going to do now? And I remembered a character I developed to entertain a colleague of mine when I'd been a social worker called Sister Mary Olga Fortitude. And I would spin these tales and leave voicemails on my colleague's telephone. And she just loved the character. I got to witness her listening to the voicemails because I left them on her work phone. And that continued until supervisors started listening in on their subordinates' voicemail. I mean, so at any rate, I thought to myself after I wrote the autobiography, I could write a book about Sister Mary Olga Fortitude. So I wrote The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude in a month, and I hadn't run out of ideas. I've written 14 books, two of which are published, Misadventures and Babes in Bucksnort. And I just finished revising them into a book that will come out with a major publisher within the next year or so, God willing. And it's going to be called The Zany Adventures of Sister Mary Olga. That book, of course, is not available now, but I was very pleased to finish it up this morning.
I bet you're celebrating, David. I bet that that's a...
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. It's a major accomplishment, and I did it in a week and a half, and I rewrote half the book. So, you know, I really worked at it hard, which is the way I go at my writing. And it's mostly channeled.
When you do that, David, how do you go? Because 14 books is an astonishing number of books to me. How do you write like that? How is it that you are so prolific? Is there a way that you just kind of sit yourself down and you say, I'm writing? Or how does that inspiration and discipline come to you?
Well, I've actually written a total of 22 books, only four of which are published now. I sit down with discipline. I write from 2 to 10 hours a day when I'm in a writing mode, which is about 6 months of the year, and I produce about 3 books a year. And what I do is I just allow inspiration to come through me, and the books pass through me, and I take dictation. And when I'm writing the novels, Sister Mary Olga Fortitude is a satire with a spiritual message. She teaches classes in advanced holiness and likes her bourbon and her Marlboros. The Reverend Mother is a reformed prostitute. The convent chef is a gay cowboy, and all the characters are
zany. That needs to be made into a movie. I mean, just the visuals of those characters.
I trust it will be. But, you know, just to finish answering your question, when I'm writing the Sister Mary Olga stories, I sit there and I speak them out loud and type as I go. And it's so fun to move from the dialogue from one nasty character to some other character that might not be so nasty, but to see their egos invoked and see how the people that are on a spiritual path have to detach with love and recognize the other person is simply suffering from some unease or dis-ease. And that to get the ego invoked is only going to reflect that ego state and lead to conflict. So it's very interesting how those books unfold, and there's a lot of humor in them.
Okay, so that's that series. Now, how about Babes in Bucksnort? I mean, just their titles are completely unique, too. How about Babes in Bucksnort?
Okay, that's the continuation of The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude. And in that book, Priscilla Bunhead, who is the town busybody and town prude, has become alarmed because she's learned of homosexuals and lesbians in Bucksnort, Wisconsin. So she engages the preacher of her aunt, Gotta Be a Bunhead, to come and wipe out perversion in the Snortlands, Snort County, Wisconsin.
Is there such a place?
No. No, but there is a place called Bucksnort in Tennessee, and that's where I got the name when I was driving back from Texas. I thought, that's the name for my fictional town. So there is indeed a place named Bucksnort, but not in Wisconsin, although I Googled it, and there's some country club or something named Bucksnort in Wisconsin.
Oh, that's hysterical. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's on the lighter side of things. And then you wrote, after you got those two done, then you wrote 50 Shades of Gay, yes?
It's just Shades of Gay.
Oh, sorry. I always want to say 50 Shades. Like,
well, you know where
Shades
that comes
from. Hello.
Yeah, but, you know, the problem with that title, and this book's going to be revised too, the problem with the title is that there are at least three other books with the same title out there. So if people are interested in it, they have to put in my author name too, which is David Clark with an E.
Okay, so then you went from the fictional side to the sort of autobiographical fiction.
Yes.
Right? And then in
Correct.
Shades of Gay. And so what was your point in the telling of that story, David? What made that be important for you?
Well, the reason it was important was because I believe that there are so many people suffering from sexual addiction that can come into recovery and embrace a happy and healthy sexuality and be free of bondage to something that they may have viewed as shameful and toxic, and I believe no shame is good. So Shades of Gay is about an alcoholic and sex addict such as I had been, who has to come to a crux in his life where he has to make a decision whether he's going to continue the lifestyle he's had or choose a different path. And it's a book of trials and tribulations. It's got humor in it, believe it or not. It's got very explicit sex because it shows addiction for what it is, and sexual addiction is not a pretty thing, and it's not about sex. It's about medicating uncomfortable feelings. So anyhow, it's also a book about transformation and about spiritual illumination. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I think that's what we're all seeking, whether we realize it or not.
So in the writing and the telling of that tale, do you feel like that was cathartic for you to do that? Or is it just that you felt like you had a message, or did you feel like it was actually cathartic as well for you personally to tell the story?
Well, I've been through several catharsis with regards to my past addictive history. And the biggest one was when I wrote my life story. And then there have been two more items since then, Shades of Gay, which has strong parallels to my own life. And then also Occam's Razor Revisited, which has the intertwining tales of recovery from various things like severe homophobia, mental illness, big depressive disorder, sexual addiction, and alcoholism. So it was very important for me to get out the message that there is hope, that there is indeed complete recovery for those that believe they don't need to be an addict anymore.
So, you know, one of the things that I love about all of your writing and your message is that you're taking kind of life's difficulties and showing people ways through that I feel are really remarkable. And then, but you did you start writing these before or after you got into recovery, or substantially into recovery, so you could actually look in the rearview mirror and say, this is now behind me now. I'm, you know, as you say, a recovered alcoholic and recovered sex addict. Did you have to get really far along in your recovery before you could go and write and share your story like this?
Yes. I am 27 years into recovery now, and at the point that I started writing, I was 17 years into recovery. But what happened was I got into recovery for alcoholism in 1988. I can safely drink today, by the way. And I used to drink a case of beer a day and sometimes a bottle. But I got into recovery from sexual addiction the following year in 89. However, I only stuck with the program for 2 years, went back out for 12 more years of field research, discovered that it was just as empty as it had been before, and was given an ultimatum by my partner, who had no idea this behavior was continuing. And so I realized I needed to return to the program. And so at the point that I wrote the books, I was about 3 years back into recovery from sexual addiction, and now I'm 13 years out.
Wow. So your writing has actually spanned more than a decade at this point.
It started in 2005. So, yeah, just past the decade mark.
Okay,
22
and then
books.
Unbelievable, David. Did you go and have any special training to write, or is this just natural sort of stream of consciousness and you just have a great flow?
It's the latter. I always enjoyed writing in school and always got A's and A pluses on stuff that I wrote. My one seeming regret is that I was told by my freshman English teacher that my writing was too complicated, and so I never took another writing course. But over the years, I had to learn to keep things simple when I kept case notes as a caseworker, and I also learned that that is the principle to apply to wise and practical living if you want to lead a sober life. I learned that many years ago in AA. There's an acronym called KISS, Keep It Simple, Sweetheart, although some people say stupid, which I don't like. Abusive. I prefer words that are affirming and uplifting and empowering. And just backing up to a comment you'd made earlier, as far as trials and tribulations go, I think what is important when you come out the other side is to embrace them as blessings, because every cloud, every dark cloud has a silver lining. And when you can realize that you've learned an important lesson and come through something and have not just survived, because what good is just surviving? I mean, life is meant to be about joy. I'm a thriver, and that's what I promise everybody can achieve. And Occam's Razor Revisited is an example, is subtitled A Simple Solution to Freedom from All Addictions.
I love that, and the cover is beautiful too, by the way, David. So let's move on and talk about Occam's Razor Revisited. So in that, kind of set the stage for us, and then you know, give us kind of the storyline, and then let's talk about some of those techniques, some of those things to help people in that way to kind of move through.
Okay. Well, I also wanted to mention that best-selling author Bernie Siegel, who is a cancer surgeon and was the author of the best-selling book Love, Medicine, and Miracles, wrote the foreword, and for that I'm very grateful. Thank you, Bernie. The book, as I mentioned, basically tells my story up front. And along with it, I not only tell the story, but I tell how it impacted me, the lessons that I've learned, and how I've come to embrace a spiritual life that's free of pain and suffering and filled with joy, which is all I believe God wants for any of us. And then I get into text. I also talk about happy memories. I also talk about funny situations, because I really believe, like the Reader's Digest says, that laughter is the best medicine. And that's why I write comedy books. I dedicate them to all adult children who deserve a chance to not take life so seriously. But getting back to the question at hand...
Well, I love that as a perspective, David. That's a great perspective, and I've never heard that as, like, the reason to write comedy, and yet you've done it in a way that's sort of honoring to everybody rather than, you know, self-loathing kind of comedy.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Great.
I hope people, excuse me for interrupting, I hope people will come to see themselves in these characters, and mostly their positive qualities, but also take a look at the shadow side. Because I think we need to embrace the shadow side of ourselves, the duality within our human experience, to heal and to walk in the light and to recognize that we always have a choice between darkness and light. And who wants to walk in darkness? And that's why we need each other in this life, to help each other find the way.
Okay, and then, so not all of you written books, but now you're moving into screenplays. I'm actually looking at a second draft for Occam's Razor Revisited. So tell me sort of now how you taught yourself to write screenplays, because that's a completely different format than writing a book. But you seem to have kind of, this looks like a normal screenplay to me. So how did you move from, you know, writing novels and, you know, books to screenwriting?
Well, actually, I'm not the screenwriter. That may have been a misunderstanding. There has been a screenplay written on Occam's Razor Revisited, which is called Think With Your Heart, which is really what the book Occam's Razor Revisited is about. And the story in the movie, which is brilliantly written by, Kevin Howard out in Washington State. He's going to take that to a major studio. He has no reservation that it will not be picked up, and he believes it's one of the most powerful stories he's ever told and that it will be a finalist at a film festival. So please say a prayer for me, people. So he's the screenwriter, not me, but I agree with you. The Sister Mary Olga books lend themselves to be movies. I'd love to see Bette Midler or Ellen DeGeneres or Sally Struthers play the title character.
Oh, what great visuals. And in fact, those are kind of visuals I had just from the vibe. So how funny is that? Okay, so as you look forward now in your writing career, which, you know, you've retired as a social worker, so that was career number one. Now you're into sort of phase two career. As you look out over your career in writing and going forward, what is it that are some of the feats that you want to undertake in the future with your writing?
I'm going to continue Sister Mary Olga as long as I continue to be inspired, because I think they will be books that will, like Forrest Gump says about a box of chocolates, be you'll never know what you're going to get. And I say you can read the book like a box of chocolates. You can either eat it one chapter at a time or gobble the whole thing up. I'd like to back up and just tell you, as far as Occam's Razor Revisited goes, I proposed a simple solution to freedom from all addictions for people who have not had an extremely challenging past with addiction, or for those who have already been through the 12 steps to use as a maintenance program. Three simple steps. And it's basically following the golden rule, doing no harm and using your conscience as your guide. Now, if you can do that, you'll never fall into the trap of making any mistakes. And I'm sorry, what was the question you had just asked me?
Well, go ahead and finish. So you have three steps. So what are your three steps?
Oh, I just mentioned them. I'll say them again.
Follow the golden rule. Do no harm.
Follow the golden rule, which is do unto others what you would have them do unto you, for those who need a refresher. To do no harm, be gentle with yourself. That's another step. Because when you want to do no harm, it's not just with regard to others. It starts with yourself, just like you need to love yourself before you can love another. And the third one is to use your conscience as your guide. If you can stay present to the moment and aware, then you can have those tools. And in Think With Your Heart, I list at least 20 tools, one of which is from recovery, and the rest of which have come out of my personal experience with therapy and working with mentors who were not necessarily in 12-step programs.
Fascinating. Well, those are good steps, too. And you do have to have a certain amount of consciousness to be able to follow those with some degree of ease. So when you look forward, David, into your writing career and legacy with writing, where are some of the challenges? Sister Mary Olga, and then are you going to do any nonfiction?
I may do some nonfiction. I'm going to mostly write fiction. I have a trilogy almost completed for Shades of Gay. I have a reincarnational romance called Intertwined Loves. None of these are out yet, by the way. And there is another book out on Kindle for 99 cents called Putting the Pieces Together, which contains some of the storyline from Occam's Razor Revisited for people that want a really inexpensive read. And that's written under my previous pen name of Davis Aujourd'hui, which I used for my first three books. And Aujourd'hui means today in French. But if you go to Amazon, for an example, and just plug in the title, it will come up. It's Putting the Pieces Together.
I love that. How creative you always are. Okay, so then you move from that venue into podcasting, and you have your show Different Strokes for Different Folks, and that's also on Blog Talk Radio, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so tell me what made you decide you wanted to go, and because a lot of times writers are very quiet people and they're not so much wanting to be out in the world and, you know, doing additional things if it's not directly to support their writing efforts. So what made you decide you wanted to be a podcaster?
Well, first of all, that description of the writer is not who I am, although that was who I was as a teenager and before I came into addiction. And addiction gave me a different personality. And then when I got into recovery, I uncovered the person I was before I'd suffered trauma. So what I see ahead is other books. I'm collaborating on an angel book for children with a woman who's like a sister to me. Her name is Beth Malko. And so that book's going to be out there. And I plan on getting into TV eventually. My agent says that she's going to make inroads to that. So we'll see what happens.
What a big world you have ahead of you.
But different strokes, thank you. Different strokes for different folks is just what it says, but it's a spiritually themed show. And the idea is that we're all spiritual beings having a human experience and that we should seek to keep an open mind, relate, not compare, and find common ground so that we don't enter into conflict. And I have a diverse offering of different guests, including best-selling authors, spiritually gifted people, psychics, seers, healers, radio show hosts like Suzanne Streisauer. She was just on my show recently. And a host of others, religious people, spiritual people, ordinary folk with a story to tell.
Yeah, David's a great interviewer, too, I have to say. Okay, so when is your show, David? When can people find you and tune into your show?
Well, they can easily go to the show and listen to the menu of podcasts by going to blogtalkradio.com/author David Clark with an E. That's blogtalkradio.com/author David Clark, or they can listen in live and call into the show at 646-727-3116 at either 3:30 p.m. on Thursdays Eastern Time or 7:30 p.m. Fridays Eastern Time. And just to let you know, this Thursday I have a special edition show at 7 with an astrologer by the name of Dennis Cole who does free charts over the phone, and he's great.
Well, nice. How fun is that for people? Okay, and then if people want to buy your books, where do they find your books, David?
Best place is Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, and what about if people want to reach out to you personally? Do you have a website somewhere that people can reach out to you that way?
I do, but it's down at present. The best way they can reach out to me is through my radio site, which is freespiritbroadcasting.com. Just click on my picture, David Clark, different strokes for different folks. And, oh, I'm sorry, click on, there's either a contact us or become a prospective show host or something like that where there's a contact form. And there may be one on my other website. Sorry, I haven't looked at it in a while. And that's authordavidclarkwithane.com.
Okay, fantastic. And for everybody listening, I will go and put all of David's information up on the Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page so that that will be there for everybody to kind of connect with, and I'll have his page for the his blog talk show up there as well. So give me about a minute parting thought, David, before I shift gears and move on to my next nonfiction author.
Well, I'd like everyone to know that peace, hope, joy, and love is a free gift when you open yourself and open your hearts and realize that that's all your higher power, that's all the universe wants for you. And you can attract that through your attitude. And I would suggest, like Oprah Winfrey said, keep a gratitude journal and write down 3 to 5 things every day you're grateful for. focus on those things in your life, those blessings in your life, with gratitude, and that will bring you to a place of joy. And if you ever slip from it, just climb back up the ladder, remain aware, and you won't slip from it.
Beautiful. Well, thanks for joining me on the show today. Perfect timing. And I'll look forward to seeing your next adventures and endeavors as they come out. And thanks again for joining me on the show today, David.
Thank you, Suzanne. Good to talk to you.
So we're going to shift gears here now, and I'm going to play a little bit, a 10-minute or 10-second musical interlude. And when I come back, I am going to have a man talking to us about college and making college affordable. So you'll definitely want to hear the show. And the musical interlude I'm going to be playing today is Mona Garcia and her song Singularity, and just a little clip from that. So enjoy this, and when I come back, we'll just jump into another interview. Welcome back to Living Life on Purpose on the Living Well Talk Radio Network. And I am thrilled to have an author who is someone who's near and dear to my heart for all the years I've worked with kids and what he's doing and how he's making and showing parents and kids ways to make college affordable. So my guest for this half hour is Reese Aristi, and he's the author of the critically acclaimed Parent-Student Manual, How to Pay for College Without Growing Broke. And he spent 35 years as a college admissions financial aid expert. And he has helped thousands of college-bound families to attain the American dream and helped kids do that. And he's going to share a lot with us about how he does this. And he's got programs that he runs out of Florida called Payless for College. So he's the founder and president of that. So welcome to the show today, Aristi.
Thank you very much.
So will you talk about your experience, Aristi, as a financial aid counselor to families and kids, and just sort of walk us through what the landscape looks like before we get into your book, because I definitely want to talk about some of the content in your book because it's so worthwhile. But talk about the landscape in the United States and what people of college age are working with and what they need to think about, or high school age students, what do they need to think about?
Okay, well, we've got two situations, getting in and paying. And families need to be aware that all the financial aid in the world is useless without an admission ticket. So paying for college is actually secondary. Getting in is first.
Well, that's right. That
and,
makes total sense.
Pardon me?
That makes total sense. So obviously, then you have to have the kids help them, and I know that there's some strategy to help them do that. So how do you help kids actually get in or work with that part of the process?
Okay. Obviously, we're in the financial aid process right at this moment, so I'll just give you some highlights on admission strategies because people need to be aware of what they can do right now to qualify for more financial aid and to position themselves for the fall when 12th graders will be in the system. And we work with students out of the box because if it comes down to the numbers and your student has a 3.8 and 1850 on the SAT or 26 on the SAT or on the ACT, and the next student has a 3.61, they've got 10 basis points more, they have 50 or 30 points higher on the SAT score, or 1 point more on the ACT, your student's out, they're in. End of story. We don't want that to happen.
Is it that close to the numbers with this thing, Reese, that they based on that?
There's an overabundance of qualified applicants, but a student needs to be more than qualified. They have to be acceptable, and we turn them into acceptable students. Because the numbers, I mean, Harvard and all the Ivy League schools reject 70 to 80% of all the valedictorians that apply. because they're like a loaf of white bread, where slice 8 is the identical to slice 13.
Okay,
it's
so how do you make kids stand out?
They don't just need smart kids. They want well-rounded students who will fit into their enrollment perfectly. That's what they're looking for, not just brainy kids, because there's plenty of them out there.
Okay, so give us what that profile looks like for a well-rounded kid from an Ivy League's perspective.
1,000 hours of community service. That sets them apart, because that's equal to an 800 on an SAT score. Doing things differently on an interview. I have my interview prep that I do with students. The majority of my students are out of state. So we do Skype, and we do emails, we do phone calls, we do faxes and everything. And when I do interview prep with students, I tell them that when they go on the interview, they bring a file folder, and there are three things that should be in there. And they haven't any idea what they're going to bring. And I simply tell them that the first thing is a resume, and I have a copy of that in my book, and it's a template, and they should use it because it's pretty black and white, and it covers all the bases. And the reason they give the interviewer the resume is because they were not able to submit it online. And here's what I've been doing for the past 3.5 years, blah, blah, blah. The second thing is a letter why I must attend Harvard or Dartmouth or the University of Chicago or FSU or whatever it might be, or Cal State. And they need to be very specific in the reasons why they want to go to that college, because perhaps, and I've got one student who's at University of Georgia, and he's working under a Nobel laureate in the chemistry department. I beg your pardon. He's not going to the University of Georgia. That's another student. This student is at Florida State. There are 50,000 students in that college. And the reason he decided to go there was because he was going to be able to study under a Nobel laureate in the physics department. That's very important. So you don't write this "why I must attend your college" essay and mention all the things that so-and-such college was founded in 1858 by 5 ministers who met in a library, blah, blah, blah. They already know that. You don't need to tell them things they already know. You need to tell them that because of so-and-so, this professor whose biography is 3 pages long, and I want to study nuclear physics or bridge technology in the engineering department, I'll be able to work under the foremost authority in the world and learn from him on a one-on-one basis, and that's why I must attend your school. Those are the kind of things that you put in the "why I must attend" letter.
That's brilliant, Reese. Absolutely brilliant. Love it. Okay.
Well, that's very out of the box, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And it means that they have to have done some due diligence, too. I mean, the kids, you know, obviously we're talking about fairly sophisticated, responsible kids, and so they've had, you know, some bigger exposure to the world, so they are actually capable of thinking that far of and articulating why you'd want to go to a particular school in just the kind of way that you've talked about, because they have some experience in that regard.
After they've been counseled properly, they have more experience.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. Knowledge is the key thing.
Yep.
And there are very few places they can get it. Okay. The third thing, and this is very critical. The interview's over. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. It was a pleasure meeting with you, and hopefully the interview was a half an hour or 45 minutes. And they shake hands. I hope to see you in the fall. And they start to walk out, and they do a 180. Oh, I forgot. And they go into their file folder, and guess what they pull out? Let's exchange business cards. Now, how many students have a business card? I mean, if they're in a band or they're an athlete, and they may have a business card, but most students don't. And I'll tell you a funny story. I had a client, his kids graduated from school, in Anchorage, Alaska. And he had his 11th grade student. He hired me for that. And he had a younger kid who was going to apply to private school in the Northeast, because there was really no private school that had the, let's just say, it didn't have the credentials that some of the Eastern schools had mm-hmm. in Alaska. So he wanted his son to go there. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I will do you a favor. I will do interview prep with your son to hopefully get him a great interview when he goes to Massachusetts with whomever. Now, does your son have any special talents? And he said, yes. I said, what's that? He said, he's an amateur magician. I said, great. Does he have a business card? No. Well, here's what he's going to have on his business card. So-and-so, I'm not going to mention his name, prestidigitationist. And prestidigitation, of course, is the science of magic. So when the interview was all, he created this, you know, business card, and we went back and forth. And when he finally went on the interview, he started to walk out of the room, turned around, handed the interviewer his business card, and the guy said, holy cow, I'm an amateur magician myself. And guess what? He got accepted.
Well, what great strategies these are. Okay, so, you know, one of the myths I think that is out there, so I think one of the strategies, I work with kids in group homes and foster kids, and I've also worked with wayward wealthy kids over the years as a social worker. And one of the things that I know is that there is not a lot of guidance for kids anymore in school.
Correct.
And it's pathetic what they don't, and there's not, they're not even offered the knowledge to be able to become empowered. So if I ask the kids, okay, so let me see what your graduation requirements look like, and then do you have a copy of your transcripts? They're clueless on both accounts. And that's a very bad place to start. So in doing the work that you're doing, or what you're talking about with me today on air, Reese, how many of these kids come from really well-to-do families? And then we're going to sort of switch and talk about how your book repairs this.
I have them from all over the place. I have families.
Okay, but are they well-to-do? From well-to-do families?
Some are and some aren't.
Interesting.
And if they have their own business, well, that's the best tax shelter for college financial aid. I've got millionaire families that qualify for tens of thousands of dollars of need-based financial aid.
Okay, so do you want to start there, or do you want to start talking about
let me start from the beginning.
Come back to that. Okay.
Well, let's start in the beginning. What families?
Okay, good idea.
In the financial aid process, students have no asset protection allowance. For every dollar that a student has, they lose 20 cents per year in financial aid. Many students have custodian accounts that they don't even know about, that grandparents have. And when it comes time to make some changes, they're usually brokerage accounts, the student is going to get a 1099 for capital gains distributions or stock profits or trade liquidations or whatever, and they won't realize that maybe grandma and grandpa or Uncle Joe put away $15,000 or $20,000 for their education, and that will hurt them substantially in the financial aid process. So any family where there is a custodian account, they need to be aware that this money belongs to the student. It was an irrevocable gift. They can't just, even if the parents have one, they can't just take the money and put it into their account, because that's an illegal transaction. And if they ever get audited, there will be hell to pay. And you don't need to worry. You don't want to have to go through an IRS audit because of a custodian account that you stole from your child. So the simple thing is that the custodian accounts, we can do asset repositioning legally, morally, ethically, to guarantee that the money will not be included in the financial aid calculations. It will still be a custodian account, but it will not be in a brokerage account or a CD or a bank or a mutual fund or whatever. It will be in a tax-deferred annuity or possibly a life insurance policy, depending on where the student's applying, and it will be outside the financial aid formulas, and it won't count against them 1 cent.
Wow.
Parents have an asset protection allowance. A family of a two-parent family, older parent, 45, has an asset protection allowance of about $36,000. And that includes checking, saving, cash, checking, savings, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, real estate other than their house. And if they're over the asset protection allowance, we can legally reposition that money, regardless of how much it is, as long as they're comfortable doing it, into a tax-deferred annuity or a life insurance policy, and it will be excluded from the financial aid calculations. If a family has a business and they have plenty of cash, they can and they're way over the asset protection allowance, the assets of the business, as long as there are less than 100 full-time employees, are excluded from the financial aid calculations. So if they have $100,000 over the asset protection allowance, they can simply lend it to their business, and now it's outside the formulas.
Wow.
That's a really
easy solution. I love this kind of thinking. This is where, you know, you go to an accountant and you ask him, what does 1 + 1 equal? And he says, whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
So I love those kind of equations. So let's talk about now how this applies to your book, How to Pay for College Without Going Broke, and then talking about, you know, like what the chapters and sections are in your book and how you've laid it out. Give my listeners kind of an overview of your book.
Well, there are two sections, admissions and financial aid. And we start in the 9th grade, and we work up to the 12th grade, which is the main event, when they actually apply to college. And depending on whether they're applying to a college that uses the CSS financial aid profile, which is a specialized financial aid form, a very invasive form that about 200 schools use, they need to do asset repositioning in the 10th grade so that any transactions that happen when the student's in the 10th grade will show up on the tax return when they're in the 11th grade, and that will have no bearing whatsoever on the 12th grade at all, because that tax return is not going to be part of the formulas. If they're not applying to a school that uses the CSS financial aid profile, and they only apply to a school that uses the FAFSA, which is every single college, then asset repositioning should be completed by December 31st of the 11th grade. That way, there won't be any transactions that show up on the other tax return.
So this is being very strategic then, and really working this thing through so that you can get the most out of what you need to get out of to get things done so that you're setting everything up for the future to
right.
really roll out the right way.
Correct. If the family owns a business, they can do income planning and pay themselves less. And perhaps if they have a bigger company, obviously less than 100 employees, that's a really large company. But if they have lower income family members, they can. There's a strategy in my book that explains exactly how to lower the parents' income by 10 or 20 or 30 or maybe even $50,000, and pay a lower salaried employee, a trusted employee, the money, and through gifting, they'll wind up getting the money back, and they'll actually save tax dollars and qualify for more financial aid. Now, if they have a business and they have children, well, of course they have children if they're going to be in the financial aid process, any child under the over 14 or older should be on the payroll of the parent's business, because students have an income protection allowance of $6,300. So if they've got two kids and they pay and they're both, neither one is under 14, they're both over 14, and let's say they're not in the financial aid process, one's in the 8th grade and the other one's in the 10th grade, and they pay them $6,500 each, that's $13,000, and they're going to do this the whole time they're in high school and the whole time they're in college. That's, $6,500? That's $13,000
right.
That there will be virtually no income tax to the students, maybe $30 or $40 or $50. But if the parents have $13,000 of income, they might pay $2,500 a year in income tax. So by putting the children on the payroll, they might wind up saving thousands and thousands of dollars in income tax by using that strategy.
So this is fascinating. I definitely know of some of these strategies from having used some of them myself before for other things. So in this process, Reese, are you is there a way that your book is, you know, like available or mainstream through, you know, like turning this into a textbook that kids are actually going to be able to, you know, have so everybody can make sense of this?
Okay, well, it's now an e-book, and I'll tell you, anyone who hears this broadcast and goes on my website, paylessforcollege.com, that's F-O-R, and sends me an email, I will send them a free ebook, and I will afford them a free phone consultation with the parents.
That's a great offer.
And the book, the reason it's no longer in text, in regular text form, is because there were so many changes in the financial aid process that the last time I got an order of books, they were almost out of date.
Out of date. Yeah.
So the ebook, when there's a change, I simply send everybody who bought the last edition the latest update. So they're up to date. But
right,
now,
right,
because of printing on demand, we're going to start reprinting the book probably later in the spring because we can now print 50 books at a time.
That's fantastic. Now, in doing this, so this is really a strategy for kids. What happens if they don't know what they want to do when they go to college or they don't know where they want to go?
Okay. They don't have to, but they better figure it out by the third year or they'll spend 5 or 6 years in the undergraduate level.
So
and
what
here, you know, it's funny. I had an appointment with somebody locally a couple of weeks ago, and they were referred to me by somebody. I don't even remember who it was. But in any event, I asked the girl what she wanted to do. And she said, well, and she was in the 11th grade, and the boy is this is the family where the older kid is at Florida State working under that Nobel laureate in the chemistry department. And I asked the daughter, I said, what do you plan on doing? She said, well, I'm not sure. I said, okay. So I took a sheet from a yellow pad out of my folder, and I drew a line down the middle, and on the left side I wrote will do, and on the right side I wrote won't do. And here's what you do: you write down all the occupations that you won't, the ones you don't want to do, you write them down first, and then you see what's left, and then you kind of try to focus on what area, whether it's sports or medicine or law or business or athletics or whatever you fall into, and then we narrow it down and find schools where they specialize with and have phenomenal programs and some of the world's best people in those departments, and those are the schools that you want to apply to as long as you have the grades.
Okay, so what happens if somebody comes to you in the 11th grade and they haven't done so stellar in 9 and 10? How do you work with them through your book to kind of make up for lost time and figure out?
Well, it depends. If there was some emotional or family issue, then we can explain that in an essay. If they just kind of were lollygagging around and were lazy and they're really smart, then they'll write that in their essay, that they kind of blew it in the last 2 years of high school, and now I'm trying to present myself, and I've got, you know, straight A's or 3.8 or 3.9 GPA, and I've been doing community service, and I've got 600 or 700 hours. I started my own fundraising organization, a nonprofit, a 501c corporation for visually handicapped, and we've been collecting glasses that we're going to ship off to people in West Virginia and Montana where people who need glasses can't afford them for one reason or another, or maybe they start some other fundraising organization. Maybe somebody in their neighborhood lost their health insurance, or, well, I guess they probably wouldn't have today because of Obamacare, but let's say their house burned down and they didn't have enough insurance and they're living in a trailer. So you pick up the banner and you go out and you try to get donations to help this family out. Or maybe there's a blind kid in the neighborhood and you do tutoring with him or her, or babysitting for a mentally handicapped child or whatever. But and you start your group and you create this organization and you hire your friends and they're the officers. but you get all the credit because you're the head honcho. And the colleges love that. I had one of my kids, a couple of years ago, I got two students into Harvard that year, first time I ever got two in one season. And the girl lived near me, and the other one lived in New Jersey. And I started working with her in the end of the 10th grade. And she had two younger brothers, and one of them was visually handicapped. And I said, well, then you need to start a fundraising organization for visually handicapped. And she did, and she collected over $25,000. Harvard was very impressed.
Okay, so let me ask on the other side of this process, because I love these kind of stories, Reese, and I love knowing somebody who's as animated and committed to kids' success as you are and what you're doing. So on the other side, how many of the kids get accepted once you go through this process with them? Because I'm going to imagine that the number is really high, you know, 90-something percent.
Well,
but what's the
number? All the kids that I work with, I have them apply to a whole range of schools where there are sure admits, mid-range schools, reach schools, but we don't apply anywhere out of the box. And then there's financially safe schools if money's going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, and they apply to 8 to 10 colleges. They get accepted to, you know, anywhere from 2 to 8. None of my students gets accepted nowhere. That's never happened, because we always had a safety school where we knew they'd get accepted. And in Florida in particular, there's a college, Stetson University is very generous, and we use that in the negotiation process. As long as the student would have been able to actually go there and get a good education, we have them apply there because they get a presidential scholarship and some other grants and whatever, and it might be $25,000 of financial aid. And then they apply to Northwestern or the University of Chicago or Pepperdine or Rice or wherever, and maybe they're a little light on financial aid. So in the appeals process, you can appeal one offer. You can negotiate multiple offers. So the kids got accepted to all these different schools. They got all these different offers, and I write these letters, and the student signs it. The college gets this letter, and they say, gee, it sounds like this kid understands the financial aid process in and out. Maybe we should come up with some more aid. And I'll give you one of my typical ones. Well, depending on the scenario, if it works, one of my kids from Florida applied to a couple of schools, and she got accepted, and I upped the offer by part of it was $2,600 because she went to school in Muhlenberg, and living in Florida, she needed a winter clothing allowance, and that was the most I ever got a student.
Oh, that's a great story. Okay, so when people do this with you privately, is there a fixed fee that you have for this kind of
service?
Yes, I have
a fixed fee for 4 years.
Right. Okay, and so
if I work with somebody's kid who just entered high school, it'll be for 8 years, 4 years of high school and 4 years of college, because they have to renew the forms. But once they're in the system, it's real easy renewing the forms, but then we have to appeal. And I'll ask you this, how many opportunities do you think there are for appealing financial aid offers when somebody applies to college and goes off to school? How many opportunities? Pardon?
I have no idea, but I'm going to say it's like a typical appeal process. You can go and go and go and go.
Well, yeah, but it's every semester. There are 8 opportunities for financial aid, not just 4.
Oh, that's
a fantastic thing. You get an award for the whole year broken down by 2 semesters, but that doesn't mean you can't appeal the second semester after the first one's over if they didn't give you enough aid.
Fantastic. Well, that makes sense. Well, Reese, I really want to thank you for joining me on the show today and sharing your wealth, commitment, and passion with my audience on the Living Life on Purpose show today and talking to us about your book, How to Pay for College Without Going Broke, and all the extraordinary strategies that you just shared with us. So thanks for joining me. Next week, I'm going to be having Rita Marie Johnson. She's up, and she's from Costa Rica. She's talking about her new book, Completely Connected, and I'll have that segment on Monday. So come join me again Monday. All the information that Reese has shared and my first author will be on the Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page, so you can find everything there. And Thanks again for joining me, Reese, today on Living Life on Purpose.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you've enjoyed the show today. Enjoy all of the quality programs and archives we offer on the Living Well Talk Radio Network. I look forward to having you back with me again next week. And in the meantime, remember, be inspired for life.